Good morning. So, you want to know how I write a poem? It's very simple, just like a rooster lays an egg. This is how the Dutch poet Martinus Nijhoff once replied when asked about his writing. And it immediately struck me as a solid reply for all the times someone asks me how I write speeches. But I also realized that for you, colleagues, this would be just another way of saying, oh, it's just talent. While we all know it's talent as much as it is hard work, it is failing and trying again, and it's gradually improving mediocre speeches to decent ones, to good and sometimes impressive ones. But Nijhoff was not just a witty poet. He believed that philosophy and religion couldn't make sense of the world anymore, and it was up to the artist to testify of the mystery behind everyday things and events, and to do so in plain language. And even though I believe philosophy can help us make sense of the world, as you will find out, I feel this last bit applies to writing speeches as well, at least to the way I write speeches for the mayor. The mayor. It's not just an atypical mayor. He also has somewhat unlikely appointee for the municipality of Groningen. As you might or might not know, the Netherlands is one of the few countries in Europe where mayors don't get elected. Formally, they are appointed by the king, and in practice, they are selected by the municipal council. Unless you knowingly or unknowingly insulted the king, then he might interfere, but municipal council. So as a result, mayors in the Netherlands are not primarily regarded as political figures, even though they have political and administrative responsibilities, and I should add, political ambitions too. They are seen as guardians of the greater good, dependable, trustworthy leaders that refrain from everyday politics, symbols of unity in times of hardship. So I won't bother you with all the details, but I would like to share with you the profile for the new mayor the municipality of Groningen came up with the last time there was a vacancy. So to complicate things a bit further, it's worth noting that Groningen is the name of the city, it's the name of the municipality, and it's the name of the province. The municipality of Groningen largely coincides with the city of Groningen. The city is the economic and cultural center of the northern Netherlands. It's also the youngest city in the Netherlands, with half of its population under the age of 35. And that's mainly because of the 45,000 students that live in the city. You should also know that there is no other city in the world where people cycle as much as in Groningen, not even in Amsterdam. So the city is littered with bikes. You'll find them in bike racks, on sidewalks, in the canals, everywhere. Someone once compared the mentality of the people of Groningen to the plain medieval churches in the surrounding countryside. Quote, "From the outside, they look small and unimpressive. But when you walk in and get to know them, you realize what beauties they are." But Groningen is also a city where two worlds seem to exist almost unaware of each other. In 30 minutes, you cycle from south to north, and in those 30 minutes, life expectancy drops by 7 years, the average income halves, and the percentage of children raised in a low-income household increases tenfold. So Groningen has always been a politically progressive city. For over a century, local politics was dominated by the Labour Party, and more recently, the Greens took their place. The municipality is currently governed by a coalition of the Greens, Labour, Party for the Animals, Socialists, and a left-wing Christian Party. So when the previous mayor, an experienced, white, male Labour politician nearing retirement age, had served his term, this is the profile the council came up with for his successor. Preferably a woman. Preferably a young woman. Preferably, considering the city's profile, a progressive young woman. Enter the current mayor, my boss. In September 2019, he took office. Yes, male, white, at the time 60 years old, member of a center-right party. So, journalists described him as a graying man who rarely has the urge to come to the fore, with the gift of coming across as serious, sometimes deadly boring, but at the same time as dry-witted as John Cleese in his best days. A man, when he speaks up, does so because there's every reason to. So when does an unelected mayor, who was appointed somewhat against the odds, who shuns the stage and avoids talk shows, who necessarily relies more on soft power than on a political mandate, when does he speak up? What does he say? And why? So the mayor often speaks in a ceremonial role, at commemorations and celebrations, at anniversaries. He awards royal honors on the king's behalf. He hosts incoming delegations and often welcomes people to conferences. He also gives lectures on a wide range of topics, such as the functioning of government, how to design cities, refugees, polarization, leadership, rule of law, cybercrime, hydrogen, list goes on. He's also one who apologizes for wrongdoings of the municipality in the past, such as participation in slave trade and the treatment of Jewish residents during the Second World War. When he really speaks up, he often discusses ethical dilemmas. He reflects on how government should function, how we can restore trust and build a sense of community. This is no coincidence. The Groningen province once was the largest producer of natural gas in Europe, but this gas extraction induced earthquakes. The first one occurred on Boxing Day, 1986, and they still occur over 50 times a year. The earthquakes affected the houses of over 200,000 people and damaged 9 out of 10 monuments in Groningen. Over 100 schools in the region are not safe for children to attend. A parliamentary inquiry held earlier this year concluded that money and political interests took precedence over the interests and well-being of the people of Groningen. And once that could no longer be denied, the national government proved unable to correct the mistakes empathically and effectively. So in Groningen, this has caused frustration, sadness, despair, and above all, distrust in what the government is capable of and whether the government cares in the first place. It's not just the earthquakes, of course, but they add up to already feelings of discontent and helplessness. And it's one of the reasons we do not shy away from reflections on how our society is doing and how it is evolving. We are not sitting it out, shaking our head in disapproval, mumbling, "I told you so." That attitude creates nothing. It does not move the world forward. We want to provide an optimistic alternative, one born not out of naivety, but out of imagination. And we ask ourselves how to do the right thing instead of just doing things right. So what can we do? One thing is to change the world a little with speeches. But not by talking about government policy. Of course, we talk about policy sometimes, but in the end, it never really is about the policy. Because policy doesn't change people's minds. It doesn't win hearts. One of the most valuable lessons I was taught is that there are three types of language. There's the visionary language of values that elicits deeply held beliefs and convictions. It answers the question why we want something. The action-oriented language of tangible things relates to what people see, touch, smell in everyday life, and answers the question what it is about. And then there's policy, a cryptic language, often consisting of long words, nondescript adjectives, which answers the question how things are done. I was taught to always combine valuable values and tangible things and stay away from policy. So yes, talk about saving our planet, about bees, breaching dikes and cheap flights, but don't talk about your cost-efficient integral green maintenance mechanism policy, please. But perhaps even more dangerous is when values are disguised in terms of policy and are presented as neutral, rational, non-partisan solutions for political problems. In the Netherlands and in many other places, the economic vocabulary of new public management monopolized the government for over a generation, exactly by doing this. Its discourse became dominant under the guise of political neutrality. And in that language, and the thinking that evolves from it, It makes perfect sense. You don't run almost empty buses. That ambulance response times become longer in sparsely populated areas. And that libraries, swimming pools, community centers where few people go should close. But we don't call these public services for nothing. They are for everyone, everywhere, even if they're not profitable. That was quite a liberal take on things for someone writing for a center-right mayor, right? Just to be clear, the analysis is not my own, nor the mayor's. We actually derive much of this from the eminent veteran labor politician Herman Cenk Willink. His ideas and similar ones offered by a wide range of thinkers are gaining ground in the Netherlands. And we agree with the core assumption that the dominance of economic language is one of the root causes of societal discontent and distrust. And that is why we share this analysis wherever we can and point out that we should change our language, to change our thinking, to change how we can be a government by and for the people. So as I was reflecting on all I just put forward, and asking myself what the mayor and I were trying to achieve, the idea posed itself on me that instead of debating politics or discussing policy, we might be actually preaching. And this awakened the amateur psychologist in me. I started reflecting on my own past. About 20 years ago, I lost my faith. But in the 18 years leading up to that decision, I went to church regularly. The church we attended was austere, the people were reserved, and the sermons I was forced to listen to, they bored the hell out of me. Or perhaps they bored me into hell. Yet, these sermons did influence me for life. The last time I spoke publicly was during a charity pub quiz in a rundown soccer canteen. And after two rounds, someone in the front row yelled at me, "You sound like a minister," and not the Martin Luther King type. But that's actually not what I meant. The sermons may have affected me more than I would like to admit. They also made me a bit of a minister when I write speeches. And I guess I finally made my parents proud. But as a minister, in the sense that speeches I write are driven by values, distinguishing between right and wrong, focus on our responsibility to the world, especially to each other, appealing to our shared humanity. And in these speeches, we often rely on the Jewish philosopher Emmanuel Levinas. Yes, what comes next is a crash course in philosophy. I figured you guys could handle this on an early Friday morning. Even though Brian suggested, I refer to Paw Patrol instead. So for those of you who don't know Paw Patrol, it's a children's show about a group of puppies who save the day, and their nemesis is a populist and clumsy mare with cats as sidekicks. So, as a father of four, I had my share of Paw Patrol. So, a sermon on philosophy it is. Levinas' ideas center around the notion of the other, capital O. And after the Holocaust, he developed the idea that we become who we are through our encounter with others. He draws on the biblical story of Abraham being asked by God to sacrifice his only son. When God calls upon him, Abraham answers with "Hineni," which translates this as "Here I am for you." It expresses a readiness to serve without reservations. And Levinas suggests we adopt this attitude when others call on us. It is a recognition we are not alone, and it acknowledges our responsibility to others. Or as the mayor would more plainly say, it is the idea that I could be you, that could be us at the other side of the table, and I'm here to figure out how I can help. I also believe this attitude can help us find a way to communicate with others in a time when truth and facts seem relics of a past long gone. We derive some hope from the ideas offered by philosopher Lisha Gashinska, who builds on Levinas. She suggests we are not living in a post-truth, but in a post-truthfulness era. So instead of countering misinformation with fact-checking and pointing out lies, she argues we cannot fight falsehood with facts alone. The challenge we face is not about how we arrive at true knowledge, but about the intentions with which claims are made. We should not strive just for truth, but for truthfulness. And truthfulness requires us to be sincere. If we strive for truthfulness, speaking is above all a moral act. Truthfulness is indispensable for dialogue, for understanding, for engagement, in other words, for human relationships. So intuitively, the mayor and I were drawn to this argumentation. And recently we discovered Dutch researchers have come to a similar conclusion by studying radicalization. They argue radicalization is fueled by feelings of injustice. How unjust something feels is as important as how unjust it actually is. And it makes no sense to tell people that sometimes what they say is not entirely true. Experienced injustice also leads to anger. But you know what the conclusion was after decades of research? Taking away the feelings of injustice, treating people fairly begins with something as simple as sincere listening. In the end, I try to work from a set of values and convictions that can be heard throughout every story we tell. So that if we would publish all the most important speeches and texts, the reader would come to understand not just the policy goals of the mayor, but much more what he believes is right, just, and noble. This ambition to change our discourse, to find a way out of our post-truthfulness era, is no easy one. It requires me to engage the material with everything I've got. There are many ways in which I can hide as a ghostwriter, but I can't hide when I'm challenged to reflect on ethical questions, on right and wrong, on my beliefs and convictions. And to be honest, I love writing those speeches the most. To be able to help others articulate deeply held beliefs, to be able to find words for what is hard to describe, to try to rebuild communities and a sense of trust, to perhaps make sense of the world. It really is a privilege to be able to try so often and every now and then succeed, even if it's just a little. I truly believe speeches can make this world a better place. And it is my pleasure and honor to be here today and learn and share with you how to become better at exactly that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Abla, for starting us off with hardcore philosophy and not children's TV shows.
Sure, welcome.
What we need to wake up. Has anyone got any questions for Abla after his speech? I'm going to ask you the first question.
Sure.
Okay, it's about this idea of progressiveness. We're talking about how people were almost wanting a mayor that met a certain progressive character trope, and you didn't get that. To what extent do you think that anyone can be made progressive if they have the right speechwriter, perhaps? Can they?
Oh, wow. Well, it turned out that the mayor is progressive on many things, but he's also very conservative on things that matter to many students in Groningen, like drug use, going out, drinking, noise disturbances. So he's like, he has a conservative lifestyle, but when it comes to what government should do and for who government is and how we should interact with each other, he's a very progressive person. And I think it helped him that we shared these progressive values and we could work from there. So we had the same values, even though we have different outlooks on life. And I think he became more progressive over the years.
Do you think that was part of your influence back
then? I think the city influenced him, yeah.
Interesting, the idea that progressiveness can be about policy, and then there's also progressiveness to do with inclusion, and they're two very different approaches. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah. You seem like a man of some conviction. I was wondering, where do your convictions end and where do his begin?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Because as a speechwriter, you're sometimes having to bridge between the person you write for, and I wonder, you sound very, very convincing. Mm-hmm. So how does that work when you're in that dynamic of matching what you think?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. First, I think it's good to point out that I'm not a political appointed speechwriter. So I work for the municipality, and regardless of the mayor, I'm the speechwriter. So if there comes a new mayor, I'll stay speechwriter, I hope. You know? But then the first time I wrote for this mayor, I chose to play it safe. So a rather neutral text, no crazy things. And he said to me afterwards, you know, I'm 40 years older than you are, We have a different life, we have different outlooks on life, but I know that through the ages and everything else, we share our basic values are the same. We share a basic look on humanity, and I want you to speak out. I want you to take risks, I want you to give it all. So, of course, I had to find out. I think every speech I have to find out where my convictions end and his start, but for 80% they're the same, so it makes it easier. But I'm very involved in the speeches we write, yeah. I'm not neutral.
Can you deliver those speeches without you?
Some of them, yeah, but not all of them. I think when it gets really difficult and there's a like a moral gray area, then I'm the one who clarifies the thinking to say so by writing. So we have a lot of discussions and he offers some suggestions, but then I'll be the one who makes the line of thought.
Yeah. One more question. Could we all just like speak up when we're asking the questions and answering, just to make sure that everyone can hear? Yes.
I would ask, do you send your drafts directly to the mayor, or are there other people reviewing and revising them? And if so, how many?
Oh, that depends on the speech. But if I ask colleagues to look at the speech, it's always because of the policy and not because of the style. So most of the times, I just send it directly to the mayor.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. I have a question about your idea of truthfulness and sincerity, which I really like, and your convictions. It seems that there's a tension there. And
sure.
I want to know how that works in practice. Do you mean that by trying to be as truthful and sincere as possible, there's a lot of self-examination of your convictions, whether they're your arguments are fair? Or did you mean we want to push back a lot against our opponent because we think they're insincere?
I didn't get the last part of your question.
Is it a lot of self-examination, or is it a lot of pushback on your opponents when you think they're insincere?
Oh no! I think it's everything but pushing back.
Okay.
So when you remember the protest of the farmers this spring in the Netherlands, and they were in Groningen, they breached the door of the province house, and they were everywhere with their vehicles. And what my mayor did, even though he was not responsible, it was not his portfolio or whatever. He just invited them to come to the table and talk about what it was about. So we're not pushing back, but we're trying to listen and to get a feeling of what people need and what they want and why they're mad or angry or sad or desperate or whatever they feel. And in our speeches, we try to address those feelings in a sincere and honest way. But I think it's more attitude than action. What do you call it? Like, it's not political. We refrain from. Does this answer your question even a little? Or?
Yes, I think it does.
Okay.
We have one more time for a short question with a short answer.
In the example of the farmers' protest, what your mayor did, just speak to each other
and discuss. The question is what the mayor.
What was your contribution to that specific example?
None. She was asking when my mayor invited the farmers to come and speak. He didn't invite them to City Hall, but it was in a village nearby in a neutral location. And what my role in that was, and it was none. No. And I think that's good because then he enters the conversation as a human being instead of as a prepared politician. So.
Thank you so much. I love that.